golly, I'm giving you penalty points. Good luck, boys. He patted us both lightly on the shoulders. She comes. When the bell is sounding, please to come out fighting. Our gloves touched lightly, though neither of us looked at the other. I walked back to my corner and sat down. The bell rang.
Go get him, PK,
I heard Jaime say as he pulled the stool out of my corner. I jumped up towards a blur of brown coming towards me across the ring. Mandoma was coming at me fast, throwing everything. His punches landed on my arms and my gloves. He had come at me so quickly that he was able to keep me in my corner, and I was forced to pull him into a clinch. The ref called for us to break as I managed to swing him around. The sun was in a perfect position, low and dying fast. He turned right into it, blinded for the split second it took for me to put a hard, straight left bang on the nose. It was a good punch, and a trickle of blood ran from one nostril. I would be bloody lucky to pull that stunt again. The sun wouldn't last more than another round, and he'd probably wised up already. Mandoma was enormously aggressive, prepared to waste a dozen blows to break through my defense. Towards the end of the first round, he caught me under the heart, and I thought I was gone. He packed a left hook like a charging rhino. I was keeping him away by jabbing my left at him. They were all scoring shots, but none of them were hurting him. The bastard was terribly strong. I spent the first round looking for bad habits, but apart from the fact that he was throwing too much leather, it was going to be difficult to fight him on the back foot. The bell went for the end of round one, and already I was sweating profusely.
Take a look at Mandoma. He's leaking, Jaime said. Christ, he hits hard. I'm going to have to keep him moving, keep him off balance. Only for the first four rounds. Look at him.
Jaime was right. Mandoma was in a lather of sweat, and with the sun so low it seemed even hotter than before.
Watch and see if he drinks in round four, I said to Solly as the bell went for round two. Just box him, my son. Keep him moving, coming to you, Solly said quietly.
Mandoma came at me just as hard in the second round, and while I took most of his punches on the gloves and arms, I realized that if he kept it up like this, he'd hurt my arms and weaken me that way. I needed to make him miss more, but he was fast as blazes, and I had all my work cut out staying out of his way. I landed enough good punches to be ahead on points at the end of the second round, but there wasn't much in it, and I was using every bit of ring craft I knew to stay out of trouble. We came out for the third, and again he came at me with the leading hand, and crossed over with a right hook that caught me on the side of the jaw. Quite suddenly I was on the canvas, sprawling on my back. I could see two of Mandoma as he retired to the neutral corner, and then the ref began to count. I knew I'd been hit hard, but felt nothing. My head was ringing, and I was using all my concentration to hear the count. At six, my eyes suddenly cleared, and at eight I was back on my feet. It had been a beautiful punch, and I knew I couldn't take too many others like it and survive. Patel wiped my gloves and made me count the three fingers he held up to me, and then six. It was all valuable time, and my head had stopped ringing. Finally, he told us to box on. Mandoma was after blood, and came in too fast and carelessly. This alone saved me. If he'd waited to get set for another big punch, he would have taken me. He wanted the knockout, and his eyes were telegraphing his punches. Halfway through the round, I was feeling strong again, and I began to work to the old plan. Ignoring his head, I went for the body, under the heart, in the soft area under the ribcage, and into the solar plexus. He'd throw a wild left hook or a right uppercut, and I'd follow in with two or three hard blows to the spot. Nothing fancy, but I could feel my knuckles digging deep. If I could stay away from the big punch, and if he kept sending me a letter every time he prepared to throw a punch, I'd eventually get him. I'd been in against fighters most of my life. Mandoma had a bigger punch than any I'd ever been in the ring with before, and he was bloody fast, but I thought he was becoming predictable, as most fighters do. Had it been the usual three-round fight, the decision may well have gone to Mandoma. By the fourth round, he had started to slow down. He'd been chasing me for three rounds, and throwing a lot of leather. The heat had to get to him. But he hadn't taken water, just rinsing and spitting. So I kept going low and hard, and towards the end of the fourth round I heard him grunt as I got three solid punches home. It was beginning to go like clockwork. Mandoma pulled me into a clinch, and on the break hit me with a beautiful left lead. I thought I'd run into a train. I went down, my arse actually bouncing on the canvas. I couldn't believe it. I shook my head, but it wouldn't clear. At the count of eight, I was only just able to stand. Mandoma had me. One half-decent punch, and I was history. The ref asked me if I was all right, and when I nodded, he wiped my gloves and told me to box on, this time not asking for a concussion count. I knew I had to hang on until the end of the round. Patel wouldn't stand for more than two knockdowns. That is, if I could have gotten up a third time.
Dance, Klein Baas, your feet. You must dance. Only your feet can keep you out of trouble.
I could hear Heel Pete, clear as anything. To my enormous relief, the bell went for the end of the fourth.
He's got a huge punch in both hands, lad, but he's slowing. I want you to box him close, so he can't put a big one in. Keep working at his body. He has to be feeling it.
You could have fooled me, I panted. But my strength was coming back. I rinsed and spat, the water cool and delicious to my mouth.
Christ, he's taking water, Jaime said. The bastard's taking water.
The first 20 seconds of the fifth round were the hardest yet. Mandoma threw everything at me, but I wove and ducked, back-pedaled and kept out of the way. He threw a left lead, and I crossed over with a right, catching him under the eye and opening it up. His nose was still bleeding, and while I hadn't hit him much in the head, I'd kept the nose bleeding with a regular jab right on the button. Nothing influences a referee more than a liberal splash of blood. Mandoma threw another left hook, telegraphing it from a yard away, and I moved in and had him on the ropes with an orthodox straight left, followed by a straight right to the head. Two copybook punches, which, when timed correctly, carry a lot of zap. The black fighter's hands came up to defend his head, and I moved in close as his gut area opened up, and in went a Heel Pete 8, right where the water he had swallowed would be. I knew the pain and the nausea would be terrible, and he gave a loud gasp as the flurry of punches went home, and tried to chop my gloves away with his own. I was ready with a right hook which caught him flush on the jaw, coming up with all my strength behind it. While his punches had bounced me off my feet, mine bounced him hard against the ropes, and then he sunk to his knees, both his gloves resting on the canvas. Blood from his nose dripped onto the grey canvas as I retired to a neutral corner. At eight he rose, but I could see he felt bad, and I moved in and began to pick him off. I could have come in swinging and tried to finish him, but a fighter like Mandoma digs deep for his courage and can always find that one last big punch. I was almost certain that he was a spent force and wouldn't recover between rounds fast enough. I'd get him in the final round. The bell went, and I got to my corner to be met by Jaime and Solly, both shouting at me.
"For Christ's sake, why didn't you finish him off?" Jaime screamed.
His gut is gone. You could have taken him. Now he's got bleeding time to recover," Solly said.
"He only needs one more big punch and he can take me out," I protested.
I was following a Heel Pete plan and not a Solly Goldman plan. Heel Pete would have wanted me to box him off his feet, not punch him.
"You must always go safety first, Klein Baas. Box, box, box. Never fight."
Solly regained his composure.
"You're right, son. I'm glad one of us is still thinking."
Whether he believed it or not, he knew he had to restore my concentration and was aware that in his excitement he'd acted foolishly. The bell went for the final round. Mandoma, desperate for strength, had taken water again. For the first minute of the last round he came hard, but his timing was out, and he wasn't putting his punches together properly. I stayed away from him, flicking lightly at his cut eye, keeping the blood coming, waiting for the chance to move in. He hit me with a right cross, which had it come earlier in the fight would have put me down. Now it lacked authority. It was time to move in. I worked him into his own corner and went to work under his heart. Three solid punches before he managed to pull me into a clinch. He was too spent to stay out of trouble. After each break, I'd move him back into a corner and set to work on his body. I couldn't believe he could still be standing. I'd never hit anyone as often or as hard. But the bastard wouldn't go down. I had to put him on the canvas again. I started to hit the black fighter hard on the nose, and his gloves went up and opened him up down below. The Heel Pete 8 became the Solly Goldman 13. the first time I had ever got a 13 combination together perfectly. Mandorma gave a sort of gurgle and then a sigh, and fell. He was totally exhausted. His eyes were open, looking at me, but his body could no longer respond, and he was unable to get his head off the canvas. He'd been boxed off his feet. His heart hadn't died. It just couldn't hold him up on its own. Mandorma was the greatest natural fighter I had ever seen. I had never been as exhausted in my life. Not only had I never boxed 6 rounds before, I'd never taken as much punishment. I tried to walk with dignity to the neutral corner as Natkin Patel started to count Mandorma out. For the first time in the fight, I heard the crowd, who were going absolutely wild.
On a shobi, 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 ingelosi.
The chorus rolled like thunder across the football field. On it went, until the microphone was pushed back into the ring, and Gideon Mandorma's seconds had helped him to his corner. I walked over to see if he was all right and to shake his hand.
You are the great chief. You are him who is on shobi shobi ingelosi,
Mandorma said. And standing on still trembling legs, he held up my hand. The crowd went wild.
It is you who are chief. Your spirit is still with you. We will be brothers, Gideon Mandorma. I see you, Pique. We have taken the milk from the same mother's breast. We are brothers.
I held up his hand and the crowd roared their applause. Mr. Nguni was back at the microphone and after some trouble got the crowd to quiet down. I had returned to my corner and was sitting on the pot while Solly was rubbing me down and Jaime held a fresh towel to drape over me.
We have seen what we have seen. You must all go to your homes. Tell the people that the spirit within the Onshobi Shobi Ingelosi lives also in the man. You have seen it with your own eyes. And it is so,
he said simply. He turned and called Gideon Mandorma and me over, and we stood next to him with our arms around each other.
We have seen the spirits fight. In this, we are all brothers,
Mr. Nguni said, and the roar of the black crowd closed the proceedings. I touched Gideon on the shoulder and returned to my corner. It was just beginning to move into darker twilight, and the smell of wood smoke and coal fires came to me again. In the distance a train whistled, cutting through the hubbub of the departing crowd. All around us black faces were grinning, and some would stretch out and touch me lightly as though I were a talisman. But most looked at me, and I could see that they believed. The legend was cast deeper and would spread further. I wondered if it would ever end. I suddenly realized that every bone in my body felt as though it had been broken. With my arm around Jaime's shoulders for support, we walked through the corridor of black bodies on our way back to the school. Black hands touched me, wiping sweat from my body and wiping it onto their faces.
There you are. What did I tell you, lads? Didn't I say it would be a terrific fight?
Solly said as we entered the school.
Blimey! Twice there I thought you was gone, my son. It's good to know you can take a punch. Let me tell you, I never seen an amateur throw a perfect 13-punch combination before. It was worth coming just for that.
Cut it out, Solly. Can't you see PK's hurting?
Jaime cut in.
Not as much as the Schwarzer, my boy, Solly said.
When we got to the shower block, I sat down and started to cry. It was as though I saw the years ahead. The pain in my body had somehow sharpened the focus of my mind. I saw South Africa. I saw what would come. Something had happened to me. Jaime was talking, but it was as though his voice were in an echo chamber. No, not an echo chamber, in the crystal cave of Africa. His voice echoed across the tops of the rainforest, down the valley just as the barking baboons had done.
"I've found it, Doc! I've found the power of one," Jaime's voice was saying.
The cave about me was shining crystal. The crystal became my pain, and the pain sharpened as the light grew more intense. My concentration focused down to a pinpoint. The sadness I felt was overwhelming. Sadness for the great Southland. In the whiteness, in the light, was a sound, as if the light and the sound were one. It was the great drum and the voices of the people. They came together as an echo.
Maibuye Africa! 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 Come back, Africa! Africa! Africa!
My life, whatever it was to become, was bound to this thing. There was no escaping it. I was a part of the crystal cave of Africa. And in the pain and confusion I wept. I could see only destruction and confusion and the drum beat. Boom, 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 and the light began to fade, and Doc entered the cave, his hair white as snow, tall as ever.
"You must try, PK. You must try. Absolutely."
Jaime put his arm around me.
"There's more to this Onushobi-shobi and Gelosi than I know about, isn't there, PK?"
"Christ, I don't know. I just don't know," I sobbed.
"Don't worry, PK. No one can hurt you. No bastard can hurt you while I'm alive."
"Doc's dead," I heard my voice saying, as though it were totally divorced from my body. That evening when we returned to Jaime's place in Pretoria, there was a message to call Mrs. Boxall.
"PK, we have sad news. The professor has disappeared. Gert and all the warders not on duty, and half the men in town are in the hills looking for him, but he's been gone 2 days. Now they say there's little chance of finding him alive."
Her voice faltered, and then broke as she began to sob. The line from Barberton was crackling, fading in and out, and Mrs. Boxall's sobs grew and receded.
"Please come home, PK. Please come quickly. You're sure to find him. You went to so many places together," she wept.
Jaime forced me to sleep.
"We'll wake you at 2 a.m. and a chauffeur can drive you the 200 miles to Barberton. You'll arrive by sunup."
I knew where to find Doc. I knew that somehow he had done the impossible, and had reached the crystal cave of Africa. Doc would be lying on the platform, his arms across his chest. In 100,000 years, people would find the cave again and would climb up to the magic platform, and they'd say, "What a strange coincidence. That looks just like the shape of a man made of crystal. A very tall, thin man." And then I cried myself to sleep. 22. No one, not even I, knew Doc's religion. But after a week, where I had visited all our old haunts, except one, with various teams of men, it was decided that a church ceremony should take place. Marie came forward and claimed that Doc had found Christ while he was in hospital with pneumonia, and my mother was ecstatic. Pastor Mulvery claimed the right to hold a burial service sans Doc's mortal remains. I didn't protest. Marie had convinced herself that Doc had said yes to Jesus, and she had notched him up as one of her most important salvations. I don't think Doc would have minded too much. Besides, his love for the great Southland was complete in the most beautiful eternity he could conceive of. Not dust and ashes, but a wonderful pagan burial that would make him a living part of his beloved Africa. His spirit would dwell in the crystal cave of Africa, looking out across the rainforest, down the misty valley and over distant mountains, which smudged blue as a child's crayon drawing. Doc's death left me completely numb. I went through the motions, but it was as though I had lost my center of gravity. Everything seemed topsy-turvy. People would speak to me, but I wouldn't hear them. Their mouths opened like goldfish in a bowl, but nothing came out. Their movements seemed exaggerated, as though by walking up to me they were growing bigger from the same spot, their feet not moving, but their bodies just elasticizing cartoon-like to where I stood. The pain was all inside, deep and dull, and I knew it was this that made me feel numb. I felt I would never be quite the same again, that I could never love as much again. I kept telling myself that I knew Doc was going to die, that Doc had been telling me himself for months. But I knew nothing about this sort of death. Death was violent and ugly like Grandpa Chook and Gil Pete, or even macabre like Big Hetty. Death, as I had come to know it in Africa, had no gently slipping awayness about it, no dignity. And so I felt Doc had cheated. He'd just gone, he disappeared. He had made death happen rather than have it happen. I felt cheated, even angry. Why hadn't he waited for me? Why hadn't he told me so that I could have taken him to the Crystal Cave? But secretly I knew that I couldn't have done it. I would have clung to the last thread of life in him. I also knew that he would have known this. But it didn't help the numbness. It didn't take away the need, the dull permanent ache under my heart on the exact spot where you work on another boxer till he runs out of steam. That was it precisely. The bell had gone, but I couldn't find the strength and the will to come out for the next round on my own. Pastor Mulvery said a lot of things about it being the end of Doc's travail and his veil of tears. He had called Doc a great piano player and gardener. The Lord Jesus has given our beloved professor a garden in heaven filled with the fragrance of pansies and sweet peas, where he can play his music for a choir of angels. The regulars in the congregation must have thought it was one of his better descriptions of the born-again hereafter, and they peppered Pastor Mulvery's eulogy with, "Praise the Lord!" and "Blessed be his glorious name!" I heard it all, but it didn't make any sense. It had nothing to do with Doc. Absolutely not.
Oh, dear, oh, goodness, dearie me. Our dear, dear professor would most certainly have chosen eternal hellfire in preference to an eternity spent in a bed of pansies and sweet peas playing for a choir of angels, said Mrs. Boxall, having been exposed to Pastor Mulvery and the workings of the Apostolic Faith Mission for the first time.
The aloe was in bloom on the hillside above the rose garden, and early on the day of the service I had climbed to our rock and cried for a while until the sun came up over the valley. On the way down I gathered several candelabra of aloe blossom, which I put in a large copper vase I found in the back room of the church. When I entered the church later to attend the funeral, it had been removed, and an arrangement of pink and orange gladioli had been put in its place. Even old Mr. Bornstein, wearing a hat throughout, attended the service with Miss Bornstein. Miss Bornstein's shiny lipstick and long red nails looked strangely out of place in a church which taught that makeup of any sort, except for face powder, was a sin. I once heard long painted nails described by a lady witnessing for the Lord as the devil's talons dripping with the blood of sinners. Miss Bornstein looked beautiful among the scrubbed, plain-faced women, with their graying hair pulled back and held by cheap celluloid clips, their hats stuck with sprigs of linen flowers, some small attempt at adornment. I could see them stealing glances at her perfect complexion, magnificent shining almost purple-black hair, green eyes, and brilliant sinful lips and nails. They would spit it all back in righteous vituperation when they next gaggled around a cup of tea to tell each other they had seen sin in the flesh, the devil himself sitting among them. Outside the church after the service, as there was no Doc in a coffin to look solemn about, the regulars were able to congratulate Marie for her spectacular conversion. Even my mother got a bit of gratuitous praise for her original foresight in bringing Doc into focus as a potential candidate for salvation. All the warders who knew Doc, including Captain Smut and the Commandant, came to pay their respects. Afterwards, Captain Smut invited me back to the prison, where the boxing team was having a wake. This turned out to be a jolly affair, more like a bryflace and sing-song, and I tried hard to be cheerful, for I suspect it was held as a gesture and as a bit of a cheer-up for me. Doc would have approved much more of this than of a sanctimonious burial service. Gert took me to one side. When I'd arrived back to help in the search for Doc, I'd taken over from him. He had barely slept for 3 days and had been exhausted.
"Tell me, man, how come we never found him? You know every place he went."
"Yeah, it's funny that. But you know Doc, Gert. He probably had a place in an old mine shaft that only he knew about."
Some place he found years ago before he met me. Gert looked at me directly.
No, man, no way. You and him was too close. I reckon you know, but ach, man, you're right. I wouldn't tell also if it was me.
Gert was a naturally quiet person who didn't miss much. He'd just been promoted to sergeant, and everyone said he was going places. Doc left everything he owned to me, including the Steinway. He left a small insurance policy worth about £20 to Dee and Dum. My mother had the Steinway moved to the lounge at home, where it practically filled the room, so that the two chairs which matched the sofa had to be put on the back veranda. A jolly good idea, because that's where everyone sat anyway. Except for church ladies and town people coming for fittings, we never had proper visitors of the kind that got sat uncomfortably in the front room, so the back stoop was perfect for the old ball-and-claw brocade chairs, which after 40 years of being stuck in the parlour saw some real bottom work at last. At first I think my grandpa was a bit hurt about the banished chairs. His beautiful wife, for whom the rose garden had been created, had originally bought the furniture. But by the time I was back for the holidays again, one of the chairs was permanently claimed as his, and had several small burn holes in the upholstery, where bits of glowing tobacco ash had fallen from the bowl of his pipe to burn through the faded brocade. Doc's cottage was well away from any other European houses on a small koppie, and his will read to me by young Mr. Bornstein showed that he owned the whole of the small hill. I moved Dee and Dum in as caretakers, although it was really intended as their home. The tiny three-room cottage with lean-to kitchen was a veritable mansion after the small brick room next to the rose nursery which they had shared. They had both been terribly distressed at Doc's death. Doc had asked them to pack food for 3 days and not to speak to anyone about his departure. When he hadn't returned on the fourth day, Dee had gone to see Mrs. Boxall, who had raised the alarm. True to her word, Dee had simply told Mrs. Boxall that Doc hadn't returned from the hills the previous evening, as his bed had not been slept in, and the ash in the tiny potbelly stove was cold. They had both confessed to me about Doc requesting food for 3 days, which meant that when Mrs. Boxall had called me, Doc had actually been gone 4 days. When I had known with absolute certainty after the fight with Gideon Mandorma that Doc was dead, he had been out 3 days. It would have taken him 2 days to reach the Crystal Cave of Africa, whereupon he would have rested, and then, sometime on the third day, climbed the cliff. Doc was a methodical man. He would have planned everything meticulously to the last ounce of his strength. Marie told me that while he was in hospital he had complained each night of being unable to sleep, and they had given him a sleeping pill. Doc would never have taken a pill, which he termed putting bad chemicals in the blood. I knew that he would now have the sleeping pills with him. Doc never did anything carelessly, and he wasn't going to be any different in planning his death. It was Dee and Dum keeping faith with Doc which prevented the search parties from going further into the hills. In 1 day a frail old man recovering from pneumonia could not have travelled far into the foothills, least of all across the Saddleback Range. I knew Doc better than that. He would have planned it, knowing his chances for success. I waited until the day before I was due to return to school, and the furor of Doc's death was beginning to die down a little, so that I'd be allowed to go into the hills alone. Telling my mother at supper the previous evening that I was going for a last ramble in memory of Doc, I left home before dawn. I knew that there was still something Doc needed. If it had not been so, he would have left some sort of message for me. Together with Dee and Dum, I searched the cottage and the cactus garden in vain. Doc wanted me to perform some last duty. I felt quite sure about this. And in any case, I needed to perform some sort of ritual of my own to mark Doc's passing. I packed a can of sardines, a couple of oranges, and filled my old school lunch tin with a tomato, 2 boiled eggs, and a couple of leftover cold potatoes. And with a bottle of water and a torch, I set off. To avoid suspicion, I didn't take rope, as I was certain I could climb the cliff without it. Pausing only at sunrise to drink and to eat a potato, by mid-morning I had arrived at our old campsite on the edge of the rainforest. Above me the cliff loomed, now suddenly meaning so much more to me. Doc, as I had expected, had used the site again.
There had been no rain for the last 10 days, and the ash in the firehole I'd dug was still fresh and powdery. To make certain, I went to the spot where I had buried our rubbish and dug it up. Sure enough, a second bully beef tin and the wrapping from a packet of Baker's Pretty Polly crackers had been added. Doc loved the dry, tasteless crackers and always bought the same brand. Half an hour later, I was standing on the shelf which led to the cave. At first, there seemed to be no sign of Doc having been there, and my heart beat furiously. What if Doc hadn't made it? What if he had fallen trying to scale the cliff and lay somewhere in the thick rainforest which grew at its base? I fought back the panic, for I knew I would have to find him and somehow get him up the cliff and into the cave and onto the platform. A task which would take me 2 days, if I could achieve it at all. I also knew that if Doc lay in the Crystal Cave of Africa, he would not have wanted me to enter. Doc was a man of great sensitivity, and the idea of subjecting me to the sight of his corpse on the platform would be unthinkable. He would have left me instructions outside the cave, in daylight. That's where his message would be. I began to search the shelf inch by inch. Doc had trained me to observe, and I knew he would expect me to make the kind of detailed examination of the shelf which would be beyond the casual searcher, so that if he had hidden something, it would not be apparent to any but a trained eye. I searched for half an hour, but the limestone shelf had been worn out of the cliff face by 100,000 years of wind, rain, and water erosion. The hollowed-out shelf was smooth and regular, and there were no cracks in the dolomitic rock. I began to doubt. Doc might have intended to leave me a message, but been on the point of collapse when he finally made it up to the shelf, saving every ounce of strength for the task of reaching the platform. And then I saw it. A dark stripe of some sort of mineral sediment, long since dry, had stained a small part of the shelf. I ran my hand over the stained rock and received a sudden sharp prick. I pulled my hand back and looked at it. A tiny drop of blood formed on my palm, sticking out of the middle of the dark patch, no more than an eighth of an inch, was the point of the blade of Doc's Joseph Rogers pocket knife. Doc had discovered that the dark sedimented patch was softer than the rock surrounding it, and he had gouged a hole into the center of it using the pocket knife. He had then mixed the sand which came out of the hole with a little water from his water bottle, and first inserting the knife with the tip of the blade only just showing, he had repacked the granules of sand to mend invisibly where he had buried the knife. It was typical of Doc. He trusted his training of me so much that he knew he could make the hiding place difficult for others to find, and that I would find it. I scraped the dirt away from the point of the blade and dislodged the small knife. Around its handle, tied with cotton thread, was a note. The hole appeared deeper than I had first suspected, deeper and wider, and behind the knife was Doc's gold hunter. With the tip of the knife I pulled the fob chain out, and then the beautiful old gold pocket watch. I stuffed the watch and chain into my trouser pocket, and with clumsy, trembling hands, picked at the cotton thread tying the note to the black bone handle of the knife. It was a page torn from one of Doc's small field notepads, and margin to margin, from the top to the bottom on one side of the page, were musical notes, minute in size, but exact, a precisely written piece of music. I turned the page. In Doc's neat handwriting was a short note centered on the page.
My dear PK, in all the world, no man has such a friend as you. Last night has come some music to my head. When it is coming, I know it is time for me to go. Maybe, who can say, it is the music of Africa. Maybe only it is my music to you. Not so good as Mozart. Never like Mr. Beethoven or Mr. Brahms, but maybe better than a Chopin nocturne. Such a little piece of music for such a long life. I am such Dummkopf, but not such Dummkopf that I don't let you be my friend. For this, I'm having 11 out of 10. I must go into the Crystal Cave of Africa now. You must not follow until it is your time also. Maybe in 100,000 years, we will meet again. Goodbye, Mr. Schmartypants, welterweight champion of the world. Your friend, Doc.
I had done my crying for Doc, and the note gave me comfort. Doc was safe, and where he wanted to be, and his secret would be kept forever. I entered the tunnel leading to the outer cave. Testing the rope handrail we'd built for Doc's entry to the cave the first time, I found it still strong. He would not have had a great deal of difficulty getting into the narrow entrance. It took me only a few minutes to work the steel hook out of the tunnel wall and to remove the rope. I returned to the cliff shelf and removed the second spike and put the two spikes and the rope into my rucksack. In a very few years, the small holes the spikes had made would be eroded from the rock face, leaving no trace of man. Only the baboons or an occasional leopard would visit the outer cave, but neither would enter the dark, damp inner crystal cave of Africa. Doc would be safe for the 100,000 years it would take to turn him into crystal, forever a part of Africa. I was home again just as the moon was rising over the valley. The pain, the deep, dull pain under my heart, had lifted. Sadness remained, but I was now proud that Doc had achieved what he wanted to do. And we would always be bound together, for he was very much a part of me. He had found a small, frightened and confused little boy, and had given him confidence and music and learning and a love for Africa, and taught me not to fear things. Now I didn't know where the boy began and Doc ended. I had been given all the gifts he had. Now that Doc was resting right, I knew we could never be separated from each other. The coffee pot left at 4 the next day to connect with the all-night sleeper from Kaapmeiden to Johannesburg. That last morning at home, I walked into the front room and opened the Steinway and started to practice Doc's music, which I'd earlier transcribed onto 3 sheets of music manuscript. After I picked at the notes for an hour, the melody began to form. It was a nocturne, with a recurring musical phrase running through it. Very beautiful, it was unmistakably African, with a sadness and yearning for something that seems to be in the music of all of the people. The musical phrasing and the recurring melody were somehow familiar, like something I'd heard in a dream or the dream time, or which simply races unknown through your blood. And then I realized what it was. It was the chant to the tadpole angel. I stopped, bewildered. Doc had never heard the chant, which had started only after I had gone to boarding school. I played the music again. It was no coincidence. The chant was clearly a part of the music. It ran through the nocturne, repeating itself in a dozen variations, but always there, clear, unmistakable, wild, beautiful. Uno shobi shobi ingelosi. Shobi shobi ingelosi. Piano notes enunciated as clearly as if the people themselves were singing it. It was getting late, and it was time to say my goodbyes to Mrs. Boxall, old Mr. Bornstein and Miss Bornstein. Gert had promised to pick me up and run us down to the station in the prison's new Chevy, which meant my mother and my grandpa didn't have to rely on Pastor Mulvery, whose anxious to escape front teeth and unctuous presence I found increasingly depressing. And I was glad that he wouldn't add to the awkwardness I always felt at departures. I put Doc's music between the pages of a slim volume of poetry by Wilfred Owen, which Mrs. Boxall had given me. Not as soppy as Rupert Brooke, but a better war poet, I feel sure, she had said. Leaving home with the knowledge that when I returned it would be to a place which no longer meant Doc, made this parting almost unbearably sad for me. My mother tried to chat brightly, but she wasn't much of a bright chatterer, and my grandpa just tapped and tamped and puffed, and turned and looked up at the mountains and said, "The cumulus nimbus is building up. Could be a storm tonight, just as the Frenchmen are in loose bud." Frenchmen was a deep red long-stemmed rose, and unless the petals were still in tight bud, the storm would damage them. Gert, who at the best of times didn't have too much small talk, added to my sense of foreboding, and made the waiting for the coffee pot to pull out almost unbearably long. I put my hand into the pocket of a new pair of grey flannel slacks, made for me by old Mr. Bornstein, and took out Doc's Hunter. I was about to click it open when I was conscious of my stupidity and quickly slipped the beautiful old watch back into my pocket. My haste in doing so immediately pointed to my guilt.
I thought I might have escaped detection, but after a couple of minutes, when my mother had turned to talk to my grandpa, Gert whispered,
"So you found him, eh? I'm bloody glad, PK."
I ignored his remark, pretending not to hear him, and I knew Gert would remain silent. A whistle warned of our departure, and the small crowd on the platform became animated, as happens when an overextended farewell is suddenly terminated. It occurred in our group, too, each of us secretly glad that the waiting was over.
"Look after yourself, son boy," my mother said, offering the side of her powdered cheek.
"There's a good lad."
Puff, puff, my grandpa shook my hand. As I looked into his face, I realized that his blue eyes had become a little rheumy, and that the skin around his cheeks and mouth stretched tightly, as happens with thin men when they begin to grow old. Gert gripped my hand in the traditional excessively firm Afrikaner manner.
"All the best, PK. See you in July, man."
He jumped into a boxing stance. It was a small physical joke to hide his awkwardness.
"Keep your hands up, you hear?"
He grinned and leant forward so that only I could hear.
"No more fighting Kaffirs, you hear? Their heads is too hard, man."
The coffee pot gave a blast of steam whistle, loud enough to belong to a much bigger, more important train. The people in the third-class blacks-only carriage yelled and screamed with delight, 5 or 6 heads and 12 arms to each carriage window waving bandanas and generally making the most of the farewell occasion, as the little train slowly left the platform. I continued to wave until the train had passed the long bend which took the platform from sight. With a conscious sigh of relief, I leant back into the green leather seat. I knew I'd have the compartment to myself until Kaapmuiden, and I cherished the idea of being on my own. It had been a long week since I had fought Gideon Mandoma. Jaime was full of news when we got back to school. He'd worked out a formal business arrangement with Mr. Nguni, and now there were 20 young black boxers training at Solly's gym, as well as 3 black boxing officials who would be trained in the handling of boxers and would eventually sit for their referees' tickets. Gideon Mandoma and 3 other young fighters were separated from the other blacks to do their workouts with me on Wednesday afternoons and before church on Sunday morning. Gideon soon became more than just a good sparring partner. He laughed a lot and had a quick wit which delighted me. His English wasn't strong, and at first we spoke mostly in Zulu, until after a workout some 3 weeks into the term, he patted me on the shoulder with his glove.
"No more Zulu. PK, your Zulu comes from my mother's breast. Now my English must come from your fists. You must teach me English."
He propped and slowly stroked his hair in a backward movement the way Jaime would do it, lightly touching it as though preening in front of a mirror.
"I have 1 good English words from Jaime."
He mimicked the way Jaime spat words out.
"Cheeky bloody Kaffir?"
Gideon threw back his head and laughed happily.
"This English I understand very good."
It was then that I hit on the idea. "We're going to start a school for Solly's black boxers," I announced to Jaime on the tram back to school after training.
"Christ, PK, isn't that going a bit far? Educate the black bastards, and before you know where you are, they'll want to take over the country."
"It's as much theirs as it is ours. More, actually," I said, surprised at his outburst.
"You're perfectly right. But can't we let them take a little longer to find out? Keep the buggers in the dark as long as possible."
"Jaime, what are you saying? I thought you were a liberal thinker." Jaime laughed.
"First and foremost, I'm a pragmatist. But there's bound to be a quid in it somewhere, although I'm buggered if I can see where. How do you propose going about it? Integrate the Prince of Wales school?"
"Come on, Jaime, take this seriously. If we go to St. John Byrne and put it to him as 2 Renaissance men and give him a whole line of bullshit about liberalism, blah, 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 I'm sure he'll be in it. We could have the black school in one of the classrooms on a Saturday night."
"Already I like it. 1 lesson a week shouldn't pose too much of a threat to white civilization as we know it on the southern tip of Africa."
"Well, what do you reckon?"
"Offhand, I can't think of a way to make any money out of it, but as Karl Marx, or was it Christ, said, man does not live by bread alone. Okay, whatever you say."
"Great. Because you have to open the subject with St. John Byrne by telling him that as a Jew, you know what it's like to be an oppressed people." Jaime thought for a moment. Fine, nothing to it. I simply go in and ask St. John Byrne to open a black school in this citadel of white privilege, pointing out to him that as an expertly oppressed person for roughly 1900 years...
Good, I'll make an appointment to see him after school tomorrow.
St. John Byrne proved more difficult than we had anticipated. He was not at all sure of the attitude the nationalist government might take to one of the country's most famous English-speaking private schools becoming the cradle of black adult learning. There were, of course, black schools, and some very good ones. But most Africans left school before they reached high school, and a great many more after only 2 or 3 years of the most basic education. Some, perhaps a majority, never made it to school at all. If in later years they wished to learn to read and write, then no adult school facilities existed for them. We seem to have reached a stalemate, with St. John Byrne promising to put the issue to the school governors, where it was almost certain to be defeated. Their idea of Christian gentlemen did not include the Brotherhood of Man, if it meant lowering the colour bar. Our arguments had been sound, but our politics naive. In South Africa, when a black skin is involved, politics and social justice have very little in common. We've been a couple of schmucks to think he'd buy it straight off like that. We're going to have to make the bastard feel guilty. It always works with a Renaissance man, Jaime said. We were sitting in the prefect's common room, which was seldom used by the other prefects after school, and was a nice private place to talk or work. I thought we'd already made him feel guilty. Guilty in the mind, intellectual guilt, yes, but guilty so it hurts inside, that's different. Jews are expert at soul guilt. Let me illustrate what I mean. Until we fought in Sophiatown, the only black people I knew well were Mary, our cook, and Jefferson, the butler. And, of course, the various other nameless servants who pretended to work around the place. The afternoon of the fight was the first time I had ever been close to African people. I mean, actually experienced them as people, not just servants or faithful family retainers, but as people with problems. I mean, just like other ordinary people. I haven't told you before, but the effect was shattering. I found myself liking them. More than that, I understood for the very first time how the persecuted Jew must have felt. When they sang for you, not just for Gideon, that was understandable, but for you also, the generosity of spirit made me ashamed of my white skin. That's the sort of guilt I mean.
Christ, Jaime, you didn't tell me any of this.
So what's to tell? You can't tell it, you have to feel it. That's what St. John Byrne needs. He needs to feel not what he is denying, but whom he is denying. We're going to introduce him to Gideon.
You had 10,000 Africans singing Sikelel Afrika to experience. Do you think Gideon can convince him on his own? He's the only tone-deaf Zulu ever born. It was true, Gideon had a singing voice like a rusty rasp on hardwood.
No, of course not. But by the time we're finished with that cheeky black bastard, he's going to sound like Othello.
Jaime and I composed a speech for Gideon Mandoma, which I must say was pretty terrific. The idea was that Gideon would learn it in Zulu, and I'd translate it into English as though hearing it for the first time. St. John Byrne would be so knocked out by the language, the poetry, and the brilliance, that he would realize the black man was not just a hewer of wood and a drawer of water, nor even a noble savage, but someone who had all the brilliant potential even to become one of St. John's people. We trained Gideon in the speech, and dressed in a white shirt, neatly patched pair of pants from an old suit, and with his old black shoes shining, we presented ourselves at St. John Byrne's study. I must say he was very gracious, and we all sat in his big old leather armchairs, and Miss Perkins, his secretary, brought us tea and Marie biscuits. We'd anticipated the offer of tea, and had practiced Gideon in the balancing of a cup on his knee, so he looked pretty suave and at home. But I knew on the inside he'd be all tom-toms and flutter. I explained to St. John Byrne that Gideon's English wasn't sufficiently fluent for him to conduct a conversation, and that I would act as interpreter. I think the fact that one of St. John's people could conduct the interview in Zulu impressed the old boy no end. Gideon, as we had rehearsed it, began in English, his beautiful white teeth flashing in one of his best smiles.
"Excuse for my English, sir. She is not so good for tell this thing in my heart."
The head nodded sympathetically. I could see the plan beginning to work already. Gideon cleared his throat and then began in Zulu. After each carefully rehearsed sentence, I translated in my best voice, keeping it low and dramatic. I do not come from a nation of slaves, but I have been made a slave. I come from a people who are brave men, but I am made to weep. I, who am to become a chief, have become what no man ought to be, a man without rights and without a future. I paused dramatically before continuing. I am 17 summers. I have killed a lion and sat on the mat of the high chief, but I have been given my place. That place is not a seat at the white man's table, and that place is not a voice in the white man's ndaba. I could see St. John Byrne was beginning to feel uncomfortable. He wouldn't know what hit him by the time we were through. Talk about guilt. Old Singe hadn't seen anything yet. To my surprise, Gideon suddenly stopped following the script.
My bondage is not of the white man's making. My bondage is not forced upon me by the white man's shambok. My bondage is in my own brain. Here in my head I carry the Zulu pride of my ancestors, but I also carry no learning. My stupidity is my bondage. It is the instrument of the black man's misery and despair. If the white man would give me his rights and the same voice, I would not be able to use them. I would still be in bondage. I would still be a servant, a black kaffir, an inferior human, because I would not know how to use these rights, how to make my voice felt amongst the people. Please, sir, my mind cries for knowledge. I wish to cup knowledge in my hand and drink it, as one drinks water by the side of a stream. I am naked without knowledge. I am a nothing without learning. Please, sir, give me this knowledge. Give me this learning, so that I too can be a man.
Gideon's words had been so easily put that I had no trouble making an almost perfect translation, and his flow was hardly interrupted. The tears rolled down his cheeks, and he made no effort to wipe them away. I realized suddenly that for a Zulu to cry is a great shame, but he couldn't wipe away his tears with the cup and saucer balanced on his knee. I leant forward and removed the cup, and looked over at Jaime, not daring to look at St. John Byrne. I could see Jaime was annoyed that I'd removed Gideon's cup. The tears were the best part, the clincher. Othello had nothing on Jaime's cheeky black bastard.
The tears are not for myself. They are for the people, Nkosi,
Gideon said softly, wiping them away with the back of his hand. I sneaked a look at St. John Byrne and saw his eyes had grown misty, and he too was struggling with his emotions.
Remarkable, quite remarkable.
Then turning to Jaime and me, he said,
This young man shall have his school, and I charge you both to give of your best.
We'd won. St. John Byrne, the senior housemaster from Winchester School and trustee of the great private school tradition to the colonies, Renaissance man and liberal thinker, had been made to touch the heart and feel the soul of black Africa. Jaime was the first to react.
Can the school supply exercise books and stationery, sir?
St. John Byrne nodded.
See Miss Perkins for a stationery authority, Levy. Your students must be properly equipped.
Thank you, sir, I said, then turned to Gideon to tell him the news. Gideon broke into a giant smile.
Many boys same like me, we thank you, Nkosi.
St. John Byrne acknowledged Gideon with a nod of his head. It was plain he was enchanted with the young Zulu chief. The school began with the black boxers from Solly's gym, its only pupils. Within a month, local chauffeurs, cooks and houseboys had swelled the ranks, and Pissy Johnson, Cunning Spider and Atherton, as well as two guys from schoolhouse who could speak Sotho, were roped in to teach on Saturday nights. Even before the head's agreement, we had dispatched a long letter to Miss Bornstein, asking her how we should best go about teaching language and numbers to adult Africans. She had responded with a superb set of teaching notes,
and several textbooks which enabled Jaime and me to prepare a complete curriculum, which I was able to translate into Sotho, Zulu, Shangaan, as well as Fanagalo. With St. John Byrne's approval, we also set about teaching the curriculum to the newly elected St. John's people, so that the night school could be carried on after Jaime and I matriculated at the end of the year. After only a few weeks, the results were astonishing. Students loaded down with homework after Saturday night's four-hour teaching session would return with everything done, anxious for more. Word of the school spread among the Prince of Wales schoolboys, and soon collections of nursery rhymes, primers, and all sorts of textbooks were brought in, and we had more volunteers than we could cope with. Then Jaime, loath to waste any free resource, hit on a one-to-one teaching method where every black student had a personal white tutor. All our black students would be taught collectively in the school hall for the first hour, after which they would break away into a corner of a classroom with their personal tutors. Every tutor worked to a set of notes supplied by us, and was required to stick to Miss Bornstein's outlines. Progress was much faster than it would have been for any white students in a conventional classroom situation. Jaime, not content with our first curriculum, worked and worked on the notes, ironing out the errors and getting them perfect. Some 4 months later, we were visited by a reporter and photographer from the Rand Daily Mail, and in the following Wednesday morning edition, we had a full-page write-up, which also contained a picture of Jaime, Gideon, and me. The article, very exaggerated, told a cocked-up version of the fight I had with Gideon, and how Jaime and I had opened a school for boxers which continued to grow, giving the impression we had become a major black education resource. It was full of inaccuracies, but nevertheless it caused some real excitement in the school. St. John Byrne called Jaime and me into his study and admonished us for not checking with him before speaking to a reporter. He suggested it was altogether a rather silly thing to have done in the light of the political situation, where black schools were forbidden in white urban areas. Coming out of the head's office, Jaime shrugged his shoulders. Any publicity is good publicity, I guess. I hope you're right. I reckon we goofed. Yeah, so do I, he said softly. The following Saturday night, the police raided us. The doors of the hall were suddenly blocked by khaki-uniformed police, both white and African. A police lieutenant, wearing a Sam Brown belt and a holstered revolver, jumped up onto the stage and blew his whistle loudly.
"This is a police raid! Everybody remain seated and nobody will get hurt, you hear?"
He stood on the stage, his legs apart, with his hand on his revolver holster, as though daring one of us to move.
"Who is in charge here?"
"Onsis," I said in Afrikaans, indicating Jaime and myself. The police officer continued in English.
"Why is there no adult in charge?"
"The class is run by the boys," I said.
"You mean white kids teach these bloody kaffirs?"
"That's right." I was beginning to gain courage after my initial surprise.
"Ach, Sussman, are you telling me you're teaching bloody stinking kaffirs their ABCs? Don't you have anything better to do with your time on a Saturday night?"
"Have you got a search warrant?" Jaime asked.
"Who are you, man?"
the policeman asked. "You answer my question first," Jaime said in an even voice.
"Hey, you being cheeky."
"He merely asked if you have a search warrant, officer," I said. The policeman suddenly realized that we were not intimidated. In fact, he was wrong. We were both scared to death.
"And what if I haven't?" he challenged.
"Then you're trespassing, and I must ask you to leave at once," I said.
"You're only a bloody kid. Who do you think you're talking to, eh?"
"If you haven't got a warrant to enter this school, then piss off," Jaime spat at the officer. To my surprise, the police officer suddenly grinned. Then, stroking his nose with his forefinger and thumb, he said,
"You're the Jew boy, eh?"
He turned towards me.
"And you're the boxer who fights kaffirs."
He pointed at the Africans seated silently in front of us.
"Let me see the kaffir you fought, man."
Without being asked to do so, Gideon rose from his chair.
"Come here, Joe Lewis. Come and stand next to the Jew boy in the kaffir booty."
The officer called a black policeman over from the doorway, and as he waited for him to come onto the stage, he undid the shiny brass button holding the flap of his khaki tunic pocket.